Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we're all about crime fiction, talking with two best-selling authors. Tana French chronicles the adventures of the Dublin Murder Squad. Her new book is The Trespasser. James Lee Burke, creator of Cajun detective Dave Robichaux, writes this time about his native Houston in The Jealous Kind. Ever since Tana French debuted with In the Woods, readers have been hooked on the cases of Dublin's murder squad, bestsellers all. Tana French has won almost every award there is, the Edgar, the Anthony, the McCavity, and the Irish Book Award for crime fiction for her beautifully crafted novels. She was born in Vermont, but all of her books are set in Dublin, her home of many years. So we are happy to be speaking with her today from Dublin about The Trespasser, her sixth novel. Tana French, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
I think of you as such a quintessentially Irish writer, and it's easy to forget that you were born in the United States. But you've said that you grew up as an international brat, and you think that outsider perspective has been really useful to you as a writer. Would you talk a bit about that background of yours?
Absolutely. I grew up, due to my dad's job, all over the world, in Vermont, in Florence, in Washington, D.C., in Malawi, in Rome, and in Dublin now since 1990. And I think it really does make a huge difference to a writer, because if you're writing about a place like Dublin, where a huge majority of the population till recently were natives, children of native Dubliners, it's very easy to take it for granted, to take for granted the little codes and assumptions that make up Dublin culture. And if you're coming from outside, Dublin's home to me, but it'll never be home in the way it is for somebody who's a proper native. And so I think I notice things. I pick up on those little things that a real Dubliner would take for granted, and it makes it easier to work them into a book.
So what is it about the Irish setting that makes for great crime fiction? I mean, I think of you, and some of my other favorites are Ken Bruin and John Connolly and Declan Hughes, and the list just goes on and on. So what is it about that setting?
John Connolly, interestingly, doesn't set his novels in Ireland, because he says, right, Ireland's so small and everyone knows each other, they'd find out who done it within a week. But that's actually what I like, is that kind of closed room intensity where everybody is connected and everybody does feel that they know things about each other, whether they do or not. Everybody feels that they know you from your accent, from your neighborhood, from who you know and who you don't. There's a kind of layer of relationship underlying every interaction, whether there should be or not. And I like that. I think it adds texture to the process of solving a mystery. I think it makes it a good place to set mysteries.
Now, there's been a great conversation going on lately about how crime fiction is such an immediate and powerful vehicle for social commentary. Mm-hmm. I think of the work of Laura Lippman, Megan Abbott, of course. And your work is so directly concerned with that in so many ways. You talk a lot about class surfaces in your novels quite a bit. And you seem to see very clearly the old Dublin shimmering kind of beneath the new.
Yes, I totally agree. I think that mystery of all genres, it's inevitably going to reflect something about the time and place where it's set, because although murder is a universal crime, unfortunately, it's so much shaped by the society where it happens, by the tensions of that society, the fears, the priorities. So even if you don't set out to write a State of the Nation novel, which God knows I never do, something of that is automatically, it's going to seep in there somewhere. And in Dublin and in Ireland as a whole, class is a big issue. You have to remember, up until 20 years ago, Ireland was 99.99% white. So society didn't form divisions along racial lines the way they did in other countries. Instead, we formed divisions along class lines, because class is very instantly recognizable here by accent. You can be pinpointed very quickly the minute you open your mouth. And people hold preconceptions, there are stereotypes, there are tensions and divisions. And I think that does come out automatically in the books, because that's a large part of the way people interact. And the other one, the old Dublin shimmering through. I've loved Dublin for a long time now, for the vast majority of my life. But one of the problems it does have is there's a tension between past and present that we don't really know how to deal with. Ireland's such a young country. It's under 100 years old as a nation. And we're stuck with this concept that past and present or past and future are somehow incompatible, that you have to sacrifice one on the altar of the other, that you can't hold on to your past in any way and still move forward into the future. And I think that struggle to somehow find a way of balancing things is very powerful in Irish society. And I think that automatically seeps through in the books.
Oh, yes. It can be powerful in New Orleans writing as well, you know, because you walk around and see the past before you every day. It's an amazing experience.
It's the same in Dublin, and you see that clash every day. You'll walk down a street that's all beautiful, ornate, wonderfully designed Georgian buildings, and in the middle of it, there'll be a place where somebody's knocked down three of those and put out some 70s atrocity made of concrete and glass. And there's that tension right in front of you, made solid.
Right. Now, one of your signatures is that each case features a different detective in the murder squad. And The Trespasser is the story of Antoinette Conway, who is the second woman after Cassie Maddox that we've gotten to know in the murder squad. And she is a very different kind of woman from Cassie. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about creating her.
Antoinette is savagely tough. She takes no nonsense from anybody, and she is very, very bad at playing well with others. Because of her experience through life with people constantly trying to define her on their own terms, she refuses to give even an inch to anybody who wants her to be anything that she doesn't feel like being. And while that's got its good side, it also makes life a little bit difficult for her. More than a little bit difficult. That's kind of how she formed, which was when I was writing The Secret Place, where the narrator, Stephen, is very much the opposite. He's a people pleaser. He'll morph himself into anything that anyone wants, it just in order to make things go well and make things go happily. And I needed another main character who was in many ways the opposite. So Antoinette developed as a balance to Stephen.
Well, it was quite amusing to write about a man who was a people pleaser for a change, you know?
He's a nice guy. You know, he showed up in Faithful's Place first, kind of being co-opted into doing anything that the narrator there wanted. He's nice, but not particularly grounded in himself.
Oh, yes. Now, you're a trained actress, and I find that books about acting often offer really great advice for character. And what comes across in your books is that detectives must be actors. They have to put themselves in the places of the victims as well as the killers. They have to make connections, and they have to perform in front of their fellow squad members even.
Oh, very much so. I mean, to a large extent, the art of being a detective involves persuasion, involves convincing people to do something that isn't in their best interest, to persuade, you know, a reluctant witness to give you information or a suspect to confess. And in order to do that, you have to be very, very good at seeing how other people work, what motivates them, what do they need, what are they looking for, do they want to talk, do they want to show themselves in a certain light, and then offering them what they need to see, putting them in the role that they want to be in, which obviously involves casting yourself as a perfect foil for that role. And in this book, though, Antoinette is feeling that pressure coming at her from a source where it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be coming at her from her own squad. They should be her backup. They shouldn't be the ones trying to pressure her into the suspect's corner or the witness's corner. And that throws her off her guard. She's used to being the actor only around suspects or witnesses, and suddenly she's being pressured to take on a role around her own squad, and she doesn't handle it altogether well.
And there is that one terrifying moment when she wishes they were all around her when they're not. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Ooh. But you know, so many actors say, what I really want to do is direct. And I think that skill comes in handy as well for a writer. And one of the things you do so well in The Trespasser is set the stage in Dublin Castle, the interview rooms, the squad rooms, the very sound of shoes on the staircases, the place you can go outside and not be seen from a window. This concern for the architecture of the place has been a really important part of your writing.
Absolutely. I lean very hard on sense of place. I think that probably tracks back to the international background as well. I mean, places have always been very important to me, and the fact that places and their atmosphere have power. They have power to create the atmosphere of what goes on inside them. They shape it. And I think the Murder Squad's building is a core character in this book to a large extent.
Now, I'm curious if you'll fess up to this. Which one of these detectives is closest to you, or which one is the one who's most fun to write? Which one have you liked the best or found the most difficult?
I'm an actor, like you said, I write like an actor, and I was never one of those actors who prefers playing facets of themselves. I've always liked playing characters. The farther from me, the better. You know, I've played 10-year-old boys and hired hit women, and that's what I like doing. And so I write narrators who are as far from me as possible, because to me that's what's interesting. I get to be me all the rest of the time anyway. On the show, I want to try to see what it's like to be somebody else, try and speak somebody else's truth rather than my own. So I don't think any of them have much in common with me. But if I had to go for a pint with one of them, it would definitely be Cassie.
Yes.
Very much so. But really, the easiest to write was Frank Mackey in Faithful Place. Because I think he's got a kind of glibness, a slickness, a very smart, sharp facility for dealing with situations that makes it very easy to find his rhythm and write his rhythm. And the hardest for me, beyond a doubt, was Scorcher in Broken Harbor, because he clings very desperately and very firmly to the rules of every situation. There are rules, they must not be broken. You must do the right thing, the way it's been laid down for you, because to him, he believes that you cannot trust your own mind. Your mind is an unreliable and dark and dangerous and slippery place, and so you have to follow the rules to protect you from the things that your mind could do if you don't. And I don't agree with any of that at all, and don't think that way at all. And I find over-adherence to the rules to be actually kind of irritating. So it was a big challenge to write that and show how, no, it's not just somebody being an irritating little stickler. It's not just somebody being teacher's pet saying you've got to do things the way you're supposed to. There are reasons why somebody might think this way, very deep ones and very not easily dismissed reasons why somebody might feel that way.
Well, I love that despite the fact that detectives' minds are often dark and dangerous places, you make room in them for recognition and appreciation of beauty. I think that's very important for us to see as readers.
I have so much respect for detectives. I really, really do. I mean, I wouldn't in a million years be able for what they do. The stakes are so incredibly high. Like, I have a bad day at work, you get an adverb overload. And a detective has a bad day at work. Somebody could die if a detective just starts a day when they're not on it. And I have a lot of respect for that. And I think that fact of being face-to-face with high-stakes, sharp-edged reality in its most blinding form would probably make you very aware of the beauty as well. You'd have to be in order to counteract all the rest of it. And everything would be brought into very sharp relief, I think, by the light that you're trying to shine on everything at every moment.
Well, it's such a pleasure, and it certainly keeps us all turning pages. We've been talking with the great crime fiction writer Tana French, whose chilling new book is The Trespasser. Tana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
James Lee Burke is one of America's most honored writers. He's been named a Grandmaster by the Mystery Writers of America, and he's received two prestigious Edgar Awards. In books like The Wayfaring Stranger and House of the Rising Sun, he's turned to his native Texas and the saga of the Holland family. Today, we'll be talking about his 35th novel, The Jealous Kind, set in Burke's native Houston. He's speaking to us today from his home in Missoula, Montana. Jim Burke, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me on your show again, Susan.
Oh, always. Now, The Jealous Kind is the final novel in the Holland Trilogy, and it's a coming-of-age story set in 1952 in Houston. And you seem to remember every detail of that time and place, right down to the geography.
Well, I hope it's an accurate portrayal of the times, and it's intended to be, at least, I think, an alternative view of the 1950s or the post-war era, which I, to my mind at least, has not been portrayed very realistically in a lot of popular media.
Well, you said the only movie that got it right was Rebel Without a Cause.
That's it. The only novel I ever read about the 50s that I thought was accurate was The Amboy Dukes, and the guy who wrote that book also wrote the screenplay.
Oh, my gosh.
Without a Cause. And I did, I didn't know that. For years, I kept saying these are the only two pieces I thought that reflected the era accurately, and it was just recently I discovered the same guy wrote both works.
It's so strange when you have a coincidence like that. My gosh. Mm-hmm. So tell us about this boy, this protagonist of yours, Aaron Holland Broussard. He's a real Texas kid. He's got musical talents. He can ride a bull. And importantly for this story, he's in love for the very first time. Yep. So tell us about making him up.
Well, I believe all the characters live in the unconscious. They're, I guess, composites. But I've never understood where either the story comes from or the characters. I believe they live in the heart of the tree. It becomes the paper you put in your typewriter, your printer today. But sometimes I start with a biographical character, but he changes as the story goes on.
What was it like for you to put yourself back into the mind of a 17-year-old boy who's confronted with this world of men that is so puzzling and so much of it is so secretive?
Well, many of the things that occurred during the post-war era were not things that we are normally nostalgic for, the Korean War, for example, and the Cold War and the McCarthy era, as it came to be called. And it was also a time that I think marked by the class war in a far more visible way than we still see it at work today. That war is still with us. I mean, if it was ever more in evidence in a political election, it's never been so visible, I think, as it is today. I mean, the same issues are always there. It's just a matter of acknowledging them. But back then, it was a war between the haves and the have-nots. We just didn't know we were part of it.
Mm-hmm. And in 1952, there was a lot of post-traumatic stress in the air from The Greatest Generation. This is a novel of uneasy fathers, many of whom are trapped in their remembrances of war and the legacy of war.
Yes, the father figure we meet in here, his name is James Eustace Broussard. He's from Bayatesh, and the natural gas engineer working in an industry that he despised because he wanted to be a writer. He's a great character, I think. He's the moral light inside the story, and the boy, Aaron, wants to honor his father, but he gets caught in some situations that are very difficult for a 17-year-old boy to handle. And he falls in love with this young woman, Valerie Epstein, the most beautiful girl in Houston, Texas. She's a great gal, oh golly. But as the story begins, Aaron describes his father, and he says his father was in the Great War, in the First World War, and his father allowed no guns in the house, and his father despised the national adoration of militarism. And you see, this is how I remember that era. This is a fact. 1945, there was people in uniform everywhere. There were 14 million men and women in uniform on VJ Day. And all of those soldiers, I remember when they came back, of course, little kids, boy, we had no idea what wars were about, and we wanted to go to one. And if I remember as a kid, if I ever said something like that around one of those men or women who had been places like Bataan and New Caledonia and Omaha Beach, they would become furious. They would become very angry. And I cannot remember one of them saying anything other than, don't let them get you, kid. Do what you have to do. Don't let the man get his hands on you. Shoot yourself in the foot. It wasn't the kind of patriotic rhetoric you expected. They were very bitter people, and they lived with horrible memories. And we didn't have terms like post-traumatic stress syndrome, but that's what many of them, of course, brought back with them. But there was no celebratory mood in these people. Not that I ever saw. I never saw it once. I remember I picked up a guy hitchhiking in North Arkansas later when I used to drive through there in the 50s. And he was a moonshiner, he told me, and he had a service tattoo on his arm. And I said, "You in the war?" And he said, "You damn right I was, 7 years, and they'll never get me again." He said, "I'll go back in these hills, and they'll never find me. And if they do, I'll shoot one of them."
Whoa.
But this does not mean they weren't patriotic. What they were expressing was their anger toward people who thought war was anything other than evil.
Well, and the sons of these men in this novel are facing a different kind of war that's coming into being, a kind of war on the streets with the influx of drugs, for example.
Yeah, this was when narcotics, heroin in particular, were deliberately introduced into the inner cities by the mafia in the 1940s. I mean, it was devastating.
Well, and I, of course, love all the stuff about Galveston. And, you know, everybody remembers the Balinese Room,
yeah.
Prince's Drive-In in Houston. People forget how easy it was just to drive down to Galveston and be on the beach.
Yeah, that's it. 45 minutes.
Yep.
But Galveston was wide open. You remember?
Yeah.
It was like Louisiana. The same people were running all the gambling, the drugs, the prostitution. But it was the underside of American culture from Miami, Palm to Brownsville.
The whole coast. Well, how much do you remember of Houston? Because you were born there, and a lot of people forget that. They think that you were born in Louisiana. So how long were you there? How much do you remember of that?
Well, I just tell people I grew up on the Gulf Coast because I did. I spent a lot of time in Louisiana. But it's actually one culture.
Yes.
The economy in both places was always predominantly governed by the petrochemical industry. And the culture was always the same. Texas, of course, is a far more violent culture. I mean, the book deals with that, too. I mean,
absolutely.
People celebrate violence in Texas, even a town called Cut and Shoot right outside of Houston. And it was named after... There was a huge gun battle in the town. This was in the 19th century that began with an argument over the design for the community church. They ended up killing each other in the street, fighting over actually whether or not the church should have a bell tower. I think that was the issue.
Well, you got to laugh. I mean, what else are you going to do? Oh, man. Well, everybody talks about your work as this ongoing study of American violence and gun culture. And so much of it lately is this legacy of war, of big global war. And now, you know, you have this remarkable combination of the war abroad and the war at home and its legacy and what this means for the men and women who are part of it, and then the young people who are growing up. And Valerie Epstein is one of these gorgeous, gorgeous young women who has managed to hold on to a kind of innocence and beauty and her love for a soldier who died, you know, and then love for Aaron. That's a remarkable kind of pristine romance to put in the middle of this book.
Well, thank you. That really states, I think, the essence of the book, and it's a love story. And Valerie, this beautiful girl who goes to Reagan High School, lost her fiancé at Heartbreak Ridge. And we meet the narrator's best friend, Sabre Bledsoe, who was based on a guy who was MIA at Porkchop Hill. And I knew his mother, and she went insane, literally. She couldn't get her boy back. He never came back. He was one of those guys that was perhaps moved across the Yalu into mainland China. People forget those things, you know,
yeah.
The terrible cost, the attrition that goes on and on.
Well, it's an amazing book. It really is. We've been talking with James Lee Burke, whose new book is The Jealous Kind. It's his 35th novel. He says it's his best, and who am I to argue with that? Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the show, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. David Billings signs Deep Denial, The Persistence of White Supremacy in United States History, Tuesday, October 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Pat Sharon, author of Reaper, Sally Michelle Jackson, author of What Dreams May Follow, Tom Kalesa, author of It Was Our World War II, and Violet Russell, author of Buccaneer Beauty, discuss and sign their books at Author Night, Tuesday, October 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Poet Clint Smith reads from Ensign's Counting Descent, Wednesday, October 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Mark Bielski, historian and a director at Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours in New Orleans, discusses his new book, Sons of the White Eagle in the American Civil War, Divided Poles in a Divided Nation, Wednesday, October 19th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Christopher Romagara, Nick Fox, and Glenn Shaheen read from their work in the Blood Jet Reading Series, Wednesday, October 19th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Mickey Pfeffer discusses her book, Southern Ladies and Suffragists, Thursday, October 20th from 9:30 a.m. to 10:30. That's at the St. Francis Xavier Sharing Program at 444 Metairie Road, part of their Historical New Orleans classes. Maria Isabel Medina signs Loyola University College of Law, A History, Thursday, October 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Celebrate the publication of the New Orleans Review's special Shakespeare issue, Thursday, October 20th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Nix Branch Library Book Club is moving to the Rosa Keller Branch Library while Nix is closed for renovations. The group discusses Imagine Me Gone by Adam Hazlett, Thursday, October 20th at 6. Big Class, that citywide reading initiative, holds its annual fundraiser, A Dark and Stormy Night, Thursday, October 20th at Felicity Church. Go to bigclass.org for tickets. Yvette Landry signs Madame Grandois at Octavia Books, Saturday, October 22nd at noon. The East Bank Regional Library in Metairie presents a reading of It Can't Happen Here, a satirical play about politics by Sinclair Lewis, published in 1936, based on the novel of the same name published in 1935. That's Monday, October 24th at 7 at the library. Fred LeBlanc of Cowboy Mouth signs his new children's book, Fred the Drummer Boy, Sunday, October 23rd at 2 at Octavia Books. And don't forget David Sedaris, whose most recent book is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. He appears October 25th at 7:30 at the Orpheum Theater. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. And for all you lovers of the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library book sale, it's back, new and improved, in Latter Library's Carriage House. Open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 10 to 2. There's still time to get tickets to the Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Fan Club's annual Halloween Ball, Friday, October 28th at 9 at the Republic. Tickets available at arvlfc.com. The Louisiana Book Festival is coming up October 29th, all day on the State Capitol grounds in Baton Rouge. Books, food, music, and a great day to visit the State Library and the State Museum. And November, as so many of you know, is National Novel Writing Month. Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop offers a special writing camp with workshops and encouragement November 1st through 14th to cheer you on your way. For information about tickets, go to tubbyandcoos.com. Pirates Alley Faulkner Society presents its annual Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans, November 9th through 13th at various locations, headquartered at the Hotel Monteleone. For more information and tickets, go to wordsandmusic.org. Also coming up in November, the New Orleans Book Festival takes place November 11th through 12th at City Park. For more information, go to nolabookfest.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.